Press play.
Curtain up and now we're in.
It's time to take a spin.
The shade and tea to spill.
Ooh, drama. Oh, that's a tweet. Did they book? Who got nominated?
They option no.
Oh, I'm not well.
What star will we talk to today? Oh, that's a gag, honey.
Say no more. Drama.
Drama.
Welcome to Drama, a podcast that covers theater,
pop culture,
love,
and life in New York City.
I am Connor McDowell.
And I am Dylan McDowell. And you know, we're talking about drama, this all-encompassing thing. It's entertainment on stage, it's entertainment off stage, it's going to Trader Joe's during peak hours, it's missing the A train right when you arrive at the station. It's the TV series Elite on Netflix,
which I'm obsessed with. Anyway, speaking of drama, okay, there's some casting news that I've wanted to talk to you about.
Okay, is it theater related?
No. This is film related. And it was announced recently that the actress Zoe Kravitz is going to be playing Catwoman in this new DC Batman film, which is also starring Robert Pattinson. So, I mean, I enjoy superhero films. I usually go to see all of them. Whether or not they're good or not, whether I'm that interested in it, I will probably eventually end up watching it, as you know. But I don't know if I care. I care about Zoe Kravitz. I think she's cool. I think she's interesting. I mean, we don't talk about Big Little Lies season two.
No, we don't.
But I think she's good. I think she's good, and I'm excited about her. I mean, the female characters in these superhero, you know, or I guess villain films that are happening now have always been more interesting to me. I mean, Michelle Pfeiffer as Catwoman. Come on. I mean,
or maybe Ms. Halle Berry as Catwoman.
Well, I don't know if we talk about that either. But, I mean, Anne Hathaway, Catwoman, I think like our favorite was always growing up, Uma Thurman as Poison Ivy in Batman and Robin.
Formative moment.
I've said before, that was probably my introduction to drag, was Uma Thurman in these wigs. And from one scene to the next, she would have a different wig and these amazing costumes and the voice inflection that she would do.
As I told Lady Freeze when I pulled her plug,
this is a one-woman show. Yes.
Iconic.
So good. I mean, we always loved that movie, even though it's like widely thought of to be the worst Batman film. But I think that's what's fun about it for us is how campy it is.
And we didn't know better. We were talking with our guest earlier about the metric of how we determine if something is art or not, or good or bad, or anything along those lines in the broad sense. And when you don't, you know, when you're young and no one is telling you what to believe
or what to think about something,
it's just fun. And we had every single action figure from that.
Oh, completely fun. And then you have Alicia Silverstone in there, like completely doing Cher Horowitz as Batgirl.
That's what we wanted at the time.
I know. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And, you know, this is a fun fact. George Clooney later said, which look this up, that he thought of his Bruce Wayne as gay in that movie.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah, you watch it and there's this
I haven't
this
rewatched female. It in years though.
I actually watched it this summer randomly.
Did that track?
In a way, he's got this girlfriend character that he's refusing to settle down with, and he's very mysterious, and it's kind of a chaste romance. So I don't know if you want to go back and watch it.
I think
it's
just playing with us.
I don't know, maybe
not.
Bruce Wayne could be gay. I want a gay superhero.
Definitely. I haven't seen The Joker yet, but maybe there's some queerness in that movie.
I know. I hope so. Our guest is we're getting a head shake in the negative, but I feel like I need to see The Joker because it's getting awards buzz, and I can't help myself, and I'll probably have to go see it, even though I don't know that I really want to spend the money, but I'll end up going.
I liked the trailer.
I did too. I also liked the Saturday Night Live spoof of it.
Yeah.
Which was really fun, which was like a Sesame Street.
Yeah, that was moment. Great.
But anyway, I'm excited about Zoe Kravitz. I think she'll be fun. You know, it'll be interesting.
She's dynamic. And I think that's what's interesting about her is, wait, and you know what? I remember reading something that she had auditioned for an earlier Batman movie.
Oh.
And they said she was too urban or too gritty or something like that.
Oh, really?
And now, I mean, I don't know if she was auditioning for Selena Kyle, but.
Yeah. Interesting.
I know. Well, I mean,
when will enough
era.
Be enough with these superhero films?
I don't know. People
Probably
always want to buy.
Because I'll still go see all of them, but we've had like four Batmans in the last like 20 years.
Yeah. Something for everyone. You know, people might have hated Ben Affleck, but other kids might have been like, oh, he's the best. So.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Someone is everyone's favorite. You know who else is someone's favorite?
Our guest today.
Yeah.
Our guest today.
Oh my God. Dylan, bring him in.
Our guest today can best be described by the word artist. Although he contains multitudes for days, he rose to fame in the brilliant, epic mammoth of a musical, Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812, and more recently mystified audiences with his performance as the Caterpillar in Alice by Heart, along with being ever-present within his witty and provocative social media presence. A Lortel-nominated actor, writer, composer, director, musician, and so much more. Please welcome to Drama,
Heath Saunders. Welcome.
Oh my God, that was dramatic.
Good.
We're not lying about it being drama.
That's what we go for.
You knew what you were getting yourself into.
Did I?
No.
Did I know what I was getting myself into?
I don't think so.
I think we did cover the fact that this was fairly like, hey, what are you doing right now? And I was like, chilling. The regrets. See what I did there?
Ooh.
Mic drop. Okay.
For the Alice by Heart fans out there,
which we are,
honestly, aren't those are the only people who are going to be interested in me talking?
Right, I don't know. Like,
you got your Russians out there,
right? Right.
Not like
would we call
the
them
hacker
Russians?
Ones? You know,
we went to see Alice by Heart twice.
Cool.
We loved it so much the first time. I had to bring my boyfriend back.
Fair.
And he is obsessed with you.
That makes sense.
And listens to Isn't It a Trial? Every day he needs a pump up song.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes I'll pick up the phone and I'll hear it in the background. You slay.
Isn't It a Trial? That one specifically?
That one specifically.
Interesting.
I'm more of a Chill and the Regret.
One day on the subway, sometimes like people will know who you are on the subway and they'll like, you like know, you like clock that
sure.
they know and you're like, oh, this is awkward. Unrelated, like three different people across the subway were like having one of those eye conversations with strangers where they're like, is that who we think it is? Which was like hilarious because I was watching the whole thing happen. And one person came over and was like, I just love your work. Thank you so much. And then left the train. I was like, okay, cool. Very fun. And I'm not saying that like sounds like I'm being cynical about it. I really was like, oh, that's very nice of you. Thank you. Another one of them came up to me and was like, showed me her iPhone. And she was listening to Chill and the Regrets. And she's like, I'm listening to you right now. And I was like, you set that
up. You did.
Like, come on. Again, charming, but
very.
Like, cool.
Yeah.
And then the third person was like, came up after, again, they like did that and then left the train. And then like the third person came up and then like talked to me for like 7 minutes about my entire career.
Oh,
like
wow.
Went through, and she was like, and it seemed very much like she was like, those people don't actually know you, but I know everything that you've done.
Diva.
And I was like, okay.
Whoa. Anyway,
but it was funny because it was just like, I don't think of myself as being like an interesting or unique person to talk to. And then some people just like see me and be like, oh, look, that's that guy who was the caterpillar in Alice by Heart. And I'm like, that is weird. Thank you. I did do that.
You did that.
That's what I did. It's weird. It's weird to think about. And then I like, listen, when I listened to the album, I was like, that's me. I'm on that album.
What do you think of the album?
It's great.
Yeah.
Huge. I mean, I'm a huge Junk and Cheek fan in general. Like his music is just like so him. And I just love it. So it's really delightful to like sing on it. And I had this like weird experience where I was like, oh, this is going to be like one of those things when I listened to Spring Awakening when I was a kid. And then like, I know these voices because they were on this thing. And then people will know me for that same reason, which is just a weird thing to think about.
Wow, that is wild.
Life is wild.
That's very special.
I know. I listened to Spring Awakening and I'm taken back to a very specific time.
Very specific. Very dark.
Truly dark. Oh my God. I was unwell during that period of time.
Yeah, it's impossible not to be.
Speaking of Heath, are you well?
Am I well? Yeah. No, it's good. We're coming into my favorite season, but also the season change. So it's like the two things together are like, I'm fine. I'm good.
That's all right. That's okay.
Yeah, no, it's like, yeah.
It's nice to know that you're not just like putting forth like this. I'm great. Everything's good. Life is happy.
Oh, absolutely not. How could I? acting is about being authentic.
yes.
I am actually very happy. I'm 2 for 2 for shows that I've paid for in the last week, which is very exciting for me.
Wow.
In the sense that they are shows that I bought a ticket for and left the show being like, that was worth having bought a ticket for.
Oh my God. Yes.
Am I supposed to like plug things randomly? Because I'm just going to plug things.
Yeah, please do. Like,
Slave Play on Broadway is absolutely worth seeing. And Heroes of the Fourth Turning at Playwrights Horizons is also absolutely worth seeing.
Wait, Dylan was just telling me that he wants to go see this.
It's wild.
Yeah.
2014. So Heroes is
a little bit, it's like a conservative story, right? Would you?
Yes, sure.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it is. It's four friends who went to a conservative Catholic school, but it's, I mean, I could spend the entire 45 minutes talking about that show specifically. I could do this about Slave Play too. Both of them, I think, are so, I don't want to say important, because I'm, because what's important is a relative cultural conversation that I'm not an arbiter of, but in both cases, it felt like the show did not end when it ended. I felt like it was the beginning of a much bigger conversation. And that for me is like what the most successful theater always is. It's like, oh, I didn't actually come here for an isolated experience. I came here for a point in a conversation that's been happening. And they both feel very much of the conversation. They know what they're saying and they know what they're not saying and they know what questions they're asking. And I find that very inspiring or compelling or
I think it's all those things. I know I had a coworker tell me yesterday that a group of my coworkers actually went to see Slave Play, and she's not really a theater person, doesn't go to see anything really at all. And what they try to do, or what she was saying to me, was people were walking. She was noticing people were leaving during the whole show. And then afterwards, the whole group of them that went, they were kind of just standing outside the theater talking about what they thought of it, what they were thinking. You know, they were like, oh, I don't really like plays, but I was thinking about this. And then she said she took her hour-long train ride back to Brooklyn with her boyfriend, and they just, they were quiet for a few minutes, and her boyfriend's kind of like, oh, I don't like theater kind of dude. And then all of a sudden was bringing up these questions of identity and, you know.
Well, I would like to point out, I warned you that I would dismantle any use of the word identity, and I'm actually not going to at this moment, but I...
That's it, coming later.
It will come. Well, it's related. It's tangential. I would say that one of the things we have to recognize when people say things like I don't like plays or I don't like musicals, usually they're lying. and when I say that they're lying, it's that what they think a play is or a musical is usually not what plays and or musicals are. It's usually they had a specific experience with either people who do them, or they saw one very bad one when they were a child, and then I was like, I was uninterested in this, and therefore it's not interesting. So in all those cases, it's funny because a lot of people creating theater think about creating theater for theater people. And on one hand, I think that's a like worthwhile thing to do because theater people all feel like outsiders. But on the other hand, people who you can go see a play and it will be whatever that thing is. And I think that part of the reason that I find Slave Play, I use those two examples, is because they're both pieces of theater that feel very much aware and responsible for what they're doing. And I think that when theater is at its worst, it's actually when theater is trying to be the theater that you expect theater to be. And that happens a lot with sort of without, again, I constantly say I don't like to throw people, artists under the bus, but there are many examples of like highly commercialized versions of things that are like, oh, you're doing what you think a musical theater adaptation of this thing should be. And that becomes this weird like bastardization of itself in a way that it's like, oh, this is the thing that people see and they think that theater is bad because they've seen a bunch of theater people saying to a bunch of other theater people, this is what theater is. And therefore that the point is people don't, if you identify as a person who doesn't like theater, you're probably lying to yourself and others. So
yeah, there you go.
Congratulations.
And that speaks to me. That makes complete sense.
Oh, 100%. And I think that is cool that like you said, the conversation around Slave Play doesn't just end when you're done at the theater, you know, it'll go on and on. I saw it last November, January, December. I don't remember. And I think about it all the time.
Yeah. It's wild.
It is. It's wild. It's, I don't want to spoil anything, but yeah, I definitely think it's worth the ticket.
Right, and that for me is like my best review of anything is like, I mean, after Slave Play, my reaction was to all of my friends who I talked to about theater, I was like, have you seen this? Was my first question. Like, did you see this thing? And they'd be like, no, should I? And I'd be like, yes. Or no, yes, I have. And I'd be like, can we talk about it? And that for me is like that's the most positive review I can give a show.
Yeah.
If with Heroes of the Fourth Turning, which I saw in a relatively early preview, my big thing was like, I literally texted all my friends and I was like, go buy a ticket for this show and go see it. Like it, it is worth you going to see, which I imagine how I would have reacted to Slave Play off Broadway too, if I had seen it then, which is like, you just need to go see it. They're like, well, is it good? And I'm like, that question, I will have a conversation with you about that after you see it. Cause I don't know if you're going to like it, but I do think you should see it. And I think it's worth seeing. And that for me is the sort of that difference is key and important.
Slave Play was just extended 2 weeks into January. Yeah. So there's definitely an opportunity. I know we're going to have to see.
So if I'm going to plug things, then I'm just going to plug them on this. I'm like, go see it now.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's great. We have sort of had to take a little bit of a hiatus from seeing shows. We've been traveling a little bit this month, but those are both at the top of our lists when we 100% start seeing things.
I do want to see The Wrong Man too.
Also saw that.
Yes. At your creative home, recent creative home of MCC.
Yeah. Also worth seeing.
Can we go back into Alice by Heart for a second here?
How long were you involved
in
Alice by Heart?
I did a workshop of it up at Vassar, the Powerhouse Theater, which was this wonderful experience. A summer ago, so before, basically the summer before we did it, and I actually joke about you're gonna get my first apocryphal audition story, because there's a sort of funny thing that happened with my audition for Alice by Heart, which is that I have truly never booked a job with less work and time, which is not to say that I didn't prepare for my audition, but it was literally like, they're like, go in for this show. You're going for the Caterpillar, blah, 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 blah. Great. I went in, I sang the song one time, and then I left. And then I essentially booked my off-Broadway debut out of that. I mean, it was like, I did not get, there were no callbacks. It was just like, hey, have this role. And apparently, I talked to Jesse, our director, about it, and she was like, yeah, you're just so unique. And it was just like, oh, that's, and they had apparently struggled with the role of the caterpillar, because it's a sort of cipher of a role where it's like, everybody sort of knows what this caterpillar is. And I mean, if you think about Alice in Wonderland, it's one of the first characters that you like have an idea about what it is.
Yeah.
This is not me trying to be like, I'm amazing. It's mostly just like when I'm talking to like kids in college and they're like, I'm like, this is a really interesting story, because essentially I had nothing to do with the fact that I booked it, except for the fact that it's just things about me. I like went into that thing and they're like, that's exactly the right person for this role right now. And that space, that's like all that I could do is just go in and sing a song. And then I booked this job, which became this sort of thing that I've now done. But it wasn't like I like went in and then like had 7 callbacks and like, it wasn't like there was no, it was just like, I was either right for it or I was wrong for it. And like, that was the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it actually helped me a lot, because it just was like, oh yeah, there is so, as an actor, I just have so little control in the way people use my body to tell stories. And I just happened to be the thing that was really interesting. And it's been both a blessing for me and a sort of curse, because I'm really wrong for most things that I go in for. It's just, and it's not, that's not a like I'm bad again that's not I'm good or bad, it's just like I'm just very specific, if nothing else. And being specific is great,
but
yeah,
it's
like, also how you're supposed to deal with that. So it's been really interesting.
That
to
is
be
interesting. Okay, also in Alice by Heart, one of my crushes was in it with you, Colton Ryan.
That's fair.
Yeah, he's so cute.
He is also very talented.
The whole cast was great. That whole experience, I mean, from an audience standpoint, was just, every time someone else opened their mouth, it was just amazing. It was kind of like seeing Spring Awakening for the first time and being like, oh my goodness, there's all these talented people and they all are unique.
That cast was stacked. I mean, literally, it was just like, it was weird to like be, just being around all those people being like, wow, everyone's amazing. This is wild. It was crazy.
And one of my favorite voices in that show is Kim Blank.
Oh, Kim Blank.
Blank.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, she's great.
And she's sung some of your original material, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Which go, I want to get into that as well, because I want to ask you a little bit about something that is called The Story of Three.
Oh my God, really?
Can you
that's what you want to go into?
Can you tell the listeners what that is and how that applies to your artist journey?
Oh God.
Drama. Artist journey.
He's speechless. The look on his face.
Well, so Story of Three is a musical that I wrote between the ages of 16 and 19. And yeah, I don't know. What else is there to it? That's what it was. I did for my 30th birthday, I was like, I made all my very talented friends do a reading of it, which was hilarious.
Oh, that's great.
To me.
Oh my God, that's so
fun. That's
what
that is.
So you're a songwriter, you're a musical theater writer, composer. How would you say that? Yeah.
Yeah, I am a composer and writer. Yeah, that is how I would say that. I'm a composer primarily.
Okay.
Mostly because I say composer primarily. I am not really anything primarily much as I am. I do a lot of things. Composing is one of the things that I feel very qualified for. I'm a musician first. All of my doorway into art was through music. So I feel most at home when I'm dealing with music. And, you know, I wrote a musical when I was in high school, which was weird.
Impressive. Did the material hold up?
In some ways, it's really interesting to watching it. When we did that reading of it, it was like, it was really surreal for me because it is so clearly all the, like, the seeds of what and who I am now. Like, it just is so, I just was like, yeah, that. So did it hold up? It's a really interesting concept in the sense, not concept. It's not actually an interesting concept. What I mean by interesting concept is that the ideas on display that I'm trying to sort of explore when I was exploring them in high school are actually really interesting because I think they're really applicable to now. I also, I'm very conscious of the ways in which I, as a young composer, was essentially inadvertently pastiching other composers. So there's like songs in it where I'm like, wow, you just listened to a Jason Robert Brown song and regurgitated it. And it's not that I think that's bad. It just was like, there's only the earliest vestiges of sort of a unique voice in it. It's like, and that's okay. It was funny. It's funny to look back on it. Anyway. Yes.
So are you working in any new musicals or anything?
Yeah, I mean, constantly. There's my sort of big work is this show called Newton's Cradle,
yes,
which I wrote with my mom. My mom is my writing partner. She didn't write the musical that I wrote in high school with me. I did that. And then now my mom and I have been working together for the last 5 years. And we wrote a show called Newton's Cradle, which was in the New York Musical Festival in 2016. We had a great time.
What a unique collaboration, mother and son.
Yeah.
Some people distance themselves from their mothers.
Yeah. Well, my mom and I have a sort of funny relationship. Like and actually that's true of anybody who's like close to me. I'm not really like a deeply intimate person. So like, okay. I don't sort of naturally live in a space of being I didn't hug people until I was, you know, 13 or 14. And even then it was like, my friends had to bribe me if they like wanted to touch me. So the way that I find intimacy or that I find connection with people tends to be through talking about big ideas. So my mom and I, our relationship is sort of based in that. Like when we see something or when we go to like see theater or we're working together, a lot of it is just like, what does it mean to talk about these big ideas? And so that's how that collaboration was born, is it was like, well, it's almost like that's like if some, you know, if you like call your mom every day.
I do.
It's a little bit, it's like that. But instead of like calling to like touch base on the things that one normally touched bases with their parents on, my mom and I talk very often, but it's often about these like very gigantic storytelling things that we're trying to do. And that's sort of how we connect. So it seemed like a natural to sort of step into the collaboration world was like a relatively natural extension of that.
How cool. You come from a very musical family, right?
Yes. Annoyingly so. Deeply upsetting. No, it's fine.
That's really
there's
fun.
A set of twins in your family.
There's a set of twins in my family. My younger sisters are identical twins.
Same.
You have two sets of twins in your family?
Oh, yeah. No. We're the identical twins.
Right.
The twin sisters.
Right.
Yeah. So there's this whole line of the Von Saunders.
Yeah, well.
Von Saunders.
Yes. You can actually read, we have a collective website, the SaundersCollective.com. You can sort of see what we are actually like as a group a little bit, and you can sort of see our projects that we're working on, and that's like it actually acts as all of our personal websites or extensions of this collective that we have.
That's amazing.
It's wonderful.
And you're close with all your siblings too.
Yes. Yeah. My brother and I lived together up till basically now, but
wow,
we're very close. It's the whole thing.
It's important. Love that.
We're close. Yeah,
I know.
Your siblings also had a shot at fame at one point.
Oh my God. Referring to what?
When you all went and auditioned for, was it America's Got Talent?
Oh, interesting. Yes.
Wait, I don't know anything about this.
Well, we talked about this because the reason that Heath and I know each other is I work at 54 Below and he came in and he did this goofy video project with the one and only Natalie Walker over
Flawless.
A year ago.
Yeah, wild.
Flawless. And it was mentioned by Natalie and you lost your mind that she referenced this deep cut family experience.
Well, oh God. Okay. What pieces of information are important to understand how this story goes? I think the thing that Natalie was referring to, though, was so two of my siblings, so three out of the five of us, went to University of Miami for school, and we were there at the same time. And when we were there, the X Factor did auditions on our campus. And so the three of us who were there auditioned for X Factor as 3/5, which was exactly as layered as it sounds.
Which season of the X Factor was this?
Season 2?
So this was Brittany.
Yes.
And Demi.
And Demi. Uh-huh. I'm shaking.
Okay, so, but, okay. So we got through to Hollywood.
Okay.
So we appeared on screen during season 2 of X Factor, and there's this amazing shot of my sister, like, single tear crying.
Oh my God.
That they used. It's amazing.
That's so peak American
Idol. So we were on, three out of the five of us were on X Factor. All of us auditioned for America's Got Talent, which was a separate question.
We loved the X Factor.
Oh my God, this is so fun.
Mm.
Well, I appreciate you sharing. 3/5, who came up with the name?
Well, it was just three out of the five of us.
Yeah,
and
there you go.
Well, and we had this whole joke where if they asked us why we were called 3/5, we had three different answers for it, which were, it's three of the five siblings, it's took us 3/5 of vodka to decide that we were going to go and do this, and then in the 3/5 compromise.
Oh God. My God.
That we, oh God, it was
I'm
a mess.
Sure they didn't air that.
Oh God, no. Under no circumstances. I can't believe that they actually put us through to, when we auditioned with Everywhere, because I had just done an arrangement of Everywhere for a not allowed jukebox musical of Fleetwood Mac music.
Oh.
So I had done this trio arrangement of Everywhere, and we just sang that. But for our second song, we sang Nobody's Side from Chess.
Whoa.
Wow.
And I'm convinced the only reason we got sent on is because all of the producers on it were all British people, and they love Chess.
Of course.
They freaking love it.
And we didn't think about that. No. I just love Nobody's Side.
Yeah,
and I was like, let's sing Nobody's Side. And it was like, we did this insane arrangement where we were, oh God, it was so, we might actually we have a cabaret coming up at 54 Below.
Yes.
We're doing our Christmas-ish cabaret in December that will probably touch on this part of our lives. And so
amazing. It's on like December 23rd or something.
Yes,
like
I
that.
Believe
yeah.
So. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad iconic. We have a little teaser right here. That's so funny.
It was wild. That was a real thing that happened.
Wow. So was that Trent and Alana?
Trent, Alana, and me.
Okay.
We're the three so it's Blake, Heath, Trent, Alana, and Claire are the five of us.
Okay.
Which, when we were a five group, we were batch because Blake, Alana, Trent, Claire, Heath.
Batch.
Oh God, it was mess.
Wow.
Oh, it was like peak mid-2000s. Like, that's like, to me, that's like being a family group that, like,
oh,
using
yeah.
an acronym of our names.
Of course.
And like some of the music that I wrote for us was like, I want to vomit when I think about it. But I did do that.
It's part of your story, and you know, we can't erase that.
Oh, and I never would want to. It's one of those things where it's like, I also like joke about constantly the fact that I like was not, I'm being good at what I do is a thing that took me a long time to, I was not good in high school. Like some people were like, oh, you watch people in high school and you're like, oh my God, you're going to like do the Jimmy Awards. And you're like, you're amazing. Yeah. I was not that. I just like wasn't good. I wasn't bad, but like getting to when people like see me now, they're like, oh my God, you do X, Y, and Z things well. I'm like, worked at that. It was not natural.
Uh-huh.
I do have a question though about Seattle, because it's known as like sort of a hub for out of town tryouts.
Mm-hmm.
What did you see anything before it came to Broadway?
Mm-hmm.
Like Hairspray mm-hmm. or anything like that?
Or if we're going to like do deep cuts, yeah. Interesting fact. I was in the out-of-town tryout of Scandalous.
With Carolee Carmello?
Yeah. So I did the Bat show when it was called Saving Amy at the Fifth Avenue Theater.
Oh, my God.
And it's funny is there's a photo that they used in Playbill that year that was for her, and they're like talking about the process mm-hmm. of her being, and I'm in the photo. Like, you can see young Heath behind.
We'll have to share it.
It's really wild. I mean, I think I posted a picture of it recently. Hold on.
Iconic.
So the show retitled itself when it moved.
Yes.
Was that the thing? It was like about a televangelist?
Yep. Well, televangelist, it was, Amy Semple McPherson is a person who you should know about. She was fascinating. Yes. And that is all I'll say about that.
Okay. He is currently looking for the photo right now.
I'm looking
now.
For a photo of me behind Carolee Carmello.
How old were you at the time?
22, 23.
Amazing.
And I was replaced by Broadway's Jesse Negger, so.
Wow.
Tragic.
So you were like just out of college?
Yeah,
or
it was okay. My first job. First professional job.
Wow. That's amazing.
It was wild. It was really like, oh, wow. And it's like this thing that I did, and I like forget that I did. And then I forget that my career has been relatively like weird and like crazy and specific and also very exciting, but also like, yeah, it's shocking to me.
And you've done a lot of Jesus Christ Superstar.
I've done Jesus Christ Superstar twice. Let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Well, you did it live.
Yes, I did Jesus Christ Superstar live, in which I was in the ensemble and understudied Brandon Victor Dixon, which
Ooh.
Was fun. Mostly because there was the process of like putting that on its feet was this wild experience where John Legend's schedule was all over the place. So I ended up being like, basically I just played Judas across from John Legend for 2 weeks, which was amazing. And also like, what is happening in my life?
That's wild.
Yeah, it was crazy.
I loved that.
Yeah.
Live.
It was great.
It
we had a great
my favorite
time.
And of the live musicals that have happened.
Anyway, so I played a prop opposite of John Legend as Judas for 2 weeks, which was lots of fun. And then I did Jesus Christ Superstar again, playing Jesus.
At the Chicago. Okay. That was the Lyric Opera, right?
That was the Lyric Opera.
And the video, because I think later that summer was when you did that duo show with,
yep, with Natalie. Yep.
And your version of Gethsemane, not a dry eye in the house.
Well, I appreciate that.
That's incredible.
It was interesting because I never thought that it was something that I could do. I don't think of, it's weird to say this, but I like don't think of my, I'm still looking for this photo.
Yeah, I was just going to say,
it's
y'all, for
really exciting
home,
to look. That I'm multitasking like this.
I can't believe how good he is.
Heath can do it all. For those of you listening,
this is how you know. I think I might have missed it. I remember tweeting at someone about it because somebody was talking about it, and I was like, and then I like tweeted this photo, and I'm like trying to think of how long ago that was, and now I'm back into the Jesus Christ Superstar, which is how I've been multitasking. Is that the pictures that I'm looking at are now associated with Jesus Christ Superstar? Which is anyway. So I did that. Life is great. What were we talking about?
We were talking about how you played Jesus.
Right.
And
so, and did Gethsemane.
Yes. So, you know, you've talked a lot. Well, we'll get to more about like your start with theater and roles and identity and everything. But was Jesus a dream role? Like, would you say you ever had dream roles or?
No, not really. And that's, I think I've passed when it would be. And now we're going to find it later. No. And I also, I don't think of my, this is a very strange statement. So I'm going to.
We can edit it out.
No, I'm just like trying to think of whether how true it will, like whether this will feel obnoxious for me to say. I don't think of myself as a singer.
Okay.
Which is like a weird thing. I can sing, but it's like
you have an unreal voice.
I appreciate that, but I like don't. So when you say things like, I don't think of myself as being able to go and do Jesus Christ Superstar. The fact that I could was this like weird shock to me. I was like, oh, I guess I can do that. So like I would never have thought to myself, oh yeah, you know what I'll be able to do is sing this role 8 times a week. I just didn't, it just never really occurred to me that that was possible.
Had you seen a production of it, like, in your youth, or?
Yes, and, I mean, it's complicated because Jesus Christ Superstar is absolutely one of my top five shows of all time. Like, if I were to, like, be like, these are my shows, they would definitely be in my top five. But almost in, like, an observing it from afar kind of way. I was like, this is a thing that I really love. And, like, the idea that I could do it was just very strange to me. It just, like, isn't something that occurred to me as a possibility. And then, so then singing Gethsemane was this, like, every night in Chicago, it was like, you know, we had this 35-piece orchestra and this like gigantic ensemble in this 3,000-seat house, and like I was like, oh, now I'm a rock star, this is very fun.
Yes.
And you know, I was playing guitar during it. Like, there's all these things about it that were like, what is happening in my life right now? And that's sort of like how I came up. I just was like, oh wow, that was weird.
I love those moments when you show yourself that you can, you know, push it, or you can do things that you didn't think you could do, and you're surprised by yourself and you're like growing and learning. I think that's what makes performance or even just life exciting, you know, like,
yeah,
just moving on to the next step, just never settling.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it was it just was like a funny thing. So like doing it now, it's like, oh, people are like, oh yeah, that should be. Well, and then of course I have the long hair and like the vague ethnicity, and people are like, oh yes, you look like Jesus. And I'm like, so there's a lot of like intersections in my life that sort of came together at that moment, which was just really interesting. It was just like, this is a fun moment in my life.
Because you were also getting to do, you were being a musician, you were performing, you were acting and singing, even though you said you're not a singer, all at the same time.
Right. It was just like all these things that I do, and then like doing them all. And so this is a really interesting moment. And then, of course, I was also given an opportunity to talk to people about theology, which was also an interest of mine. So I was like, this is everything that I want to do simultaneously, except for writing. I wasn't really writing at the time. But
well, you were tweeting, I'm sure.
Constant tweeting. Always tweeting. It's
I'm talking about like you, because you also played guitar on stage in Great Comet, right? Mm-hmm. What was that experience like? Because you were in an iteration of it before it came to Broadway.
Uh-huh. Also weird, because I do not think of myself as a guitarist.
And you played it on stage in multiple productions.
Yeah, it's like now, like people are like, "Oh, he plays guitar, bring him on." And I was like, nah, "I'm a pianist. The piano is my first instrument. I play many instruments. The piano is sort of my
and primary. Oboe. And I need oboe. To just. I'm an oboist.
Oh,
a former oboist.
I was like a very serious oboist all through high school.
I almost did it in college.
That was well. I was like an all Northwest orchestra.
Wow.
Like,
oh, yes. Wow. I didn't go that intense.
Yeah, I was like an oboist.
That double reeds.
Double reeds.
Well, and then you have to like make your own reeds. And that's when I was like,
I didn't get that far.
I was like, no.
I actually, really quick sidebar, my first teacher would make me bring reeds that I had bought at the store. Mm-hmm. And she would then practice her own reed cutting and work on it. And so every week I would say to my mom, we need to go back to the music store. Stephanie needs me to bring more reeds. And she'd be like, Dylan, I've spent $100. Because they weren't cheap.
Yeah, no, that's wild.
And now I'm realizing that Stephanie,
was taking
who
advantage.
Eloped to Nebraska midway through our lessons, you know what I mean? She took total advantage of me. And I hope that wherever you are out there.
Wow.
She's a scammer.
That is a scam. I mean, that is literally a scam. It's like wild for me to think about that, because I think about like somebody just getting their students to bring them. That's wild.
Where is the true crime doc about this?
So going back to Great Comet, you were kind of talking about how it was an interesting intersection of your different passions. When did this come into your life?
So immediately I had this moment when I was like going to give up theater performing completely, because I was like, I hate this.
Whoa.
Yeah, I don't hate performing. I hate the life that is required for performances for performers to sustain in order to make a career out of performing at, you know, peak 2015 was like, I hate this. I hate every second of it. I like performing. I just don't like everything else. And I was like, okay, that's fine. And then along comes this little audition for this crazy show called Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812. And it was like, it was weird, because it was like a week. It was like, I was like, never doing it again. And then this audition came along. And I was like, this sounds crazy.
Whoa.
And then I was like, booked that job immediately after that. And I was like, oh, well, this part isn't so bad. Largely because that cast and that creative team, everything about that process was this like weird artistic bubble of delight. And that was 2 years of my life. So it began and it totally changed how I like look at myself as a performer and an artist and a creator. And it put me into this position where I was like, oh, now I'm fine. So now I'm like happy to do things in a much more relaxed way. Cause it helped me remove being an actor or being a performer from being like an intrinsic part of my identity, that in fact, it is in fact something that I do, not something, not who I am. And that shift in perspective allows me to do it with much more grace and openness and compassion than I could before, when I was super concerned about my own identity, mm-hmm. which as an extension is part of what I was talking about before, which is why I'm like, I think that that's, it's that journey that I went on with this sort of specific identity, this of creator or of artist or actor, is a, the same identity that I associate with my relationship to my gender and my relationship to my sexuality and my relationship to my race. It's all about, these are things that I actually do. They are not who I am. They're words that I give people to help us ease my interaction there. But who I am is something that's a weird conglomeration / Venn diagram / all of these things coming together to make a self, which are, is not defined by any of those specific things. That was like way intense for an answer about what was it like to be in comment.
No, I love that. I love that. You know, people insist on labeling everything. I think it's
We insist on labeling ourselves. That for me is the bigger problem. Like for me, yeah, we insist on labeling each other, but the way that we take labels on for ourselves is the thing that I'm most interested in dismantling. Where it's like the way that we see ourselves. You know, I say this a lot, but like, identity is actually a two-way street. Like, your identity isn't just what you decide you are. Identity is also how you're perceived, and that's how privilege manifests, right? Mm-hmm. The thing about privilege is that it actually doesn't matter how you see yourself. It only matters how other people see you. So somebody who, like, I'm a light-skinned person of color. So I have all these advantages that come with being light-skinned, would come with being interpreted as male, would come with being tall, which come with being all of these things that have nothing to do with how I feel. And I don't have to identify as those things to take advantage of those privileges that I'm afforded for being those things. And I think it's really important to be able to talk about both of those things simultaneously and separate when we're talking about these are the advantages that I'm given because of the way that I'm perceived, versus these are the ways that I feel. And the dysphoria that comes from me feeling some way that I'm not being interpreted is really difficult. And I acknowledge that, but that dysphoria is not the primary conversation we should be talking about when it comes to conversations about identity. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we should. I think that we should be affording people the space to define themselves however they want, as long as we continue to talk about the way that that definition, that self-definition, intersects with society's definitions of self. So, because you can't, I cannot walk around saying that my experience with, for example, my own queerness is my defining characteristic if people don't see that or people don't interpret that as part of who I am. And that conundrum is why I'm like, white gay men can be obnoxious people because they're not acknowledging the fact that their own experience of identity is something that they are, it's actually more about them than it is about other people. Mm-hmm. And that's not bad in the sense that everybody struggles with identity in many different ways. Sure. But we're unable, because we're so focused on the ways in which they're my rights, quote unquote. And I don't say that to be like, I would want to dismantle people's understanding of rights. People's rights are in danger. We live in a dangerous time. I'm not saying anything here to take away from that experience.
Right.
But when you come into a conversation and you say, this is my experience and my experience matters more than the societal conversation, while bringing that conversation into that sort of like, let's talk about the macro, when you can't acknowledge the ways that intersection plays out. And I'm at a unique space of privilege in this regard, because I you know, my identity lives at the intersection of all of these different things about myself. And so I can like easily shift and sort of code switch which identity is the most important or the most disenfranchised within a conversation. So like when the three of us are talking, I can be like, well, I'm the person of color in the room. Or if I'm talking with a bunch of straight people, I can be like, well, I'm the queer one. Or if I'm talking with a bunch of black people, I am the person who is light-skinned. Like I can do these things where I can like re-angle myself as the one who has a unique experience. And society would ask that I continue to do that without acknowledging the ways in which doing that takes advantage, is actually utilizing my privilege, which is that I can be chameleonic in these ways. And again, I am not saying that to be like my life is easy or my life is hard. It really has nothing to do with my life in relation to anyone else's life. I am just describing my experience of life,
right,
which is essentially what identity is.
Amen. Mike drops.
I feel like we could do a whole extra episode. Just,
yeah, it was like, this is like the...
You're a philosopher.
Constantly.
That's incredible. I think your self-awareness is... I'm learning myself
right now. Oh, thank God.
Yes.
Wouldn't it be awkward if you weren't?
I was like, yeah, cool. Anyways.
Me, I've learned everything, so no. There's nothing else for me to learn. This is it.
I think your experience is so valuable, and I'm so grateful that you are sharing it with us. Mm-hmm. And we're kind of like running short on time.
I know,
here.
I was like, whoa, I could talk about anything for hours.
I know. Oh my gosh. Should we ask them the question?
Yeah, let's go ahead with the question that we...
The
one that we hinted at earlier and talked about off pod.
I'm going to like aggressively pivot how I answer this, is what I'm going to do.
Oh my God. Dylan, take it away.
So this is your Ring of Keys moment. This is the moment of seeing the embodiment of your artistic identity for the first time and realizing that art or theater or something along those lines was for you.
Like something that maybe isn't not necessarily a career, but maybe it was what just intrigued you. Or...
Well, so I naturally just went off on this whole tangent about identity.
Yeah.
And you understand that how this question intersects with that conversation in all these ways. But I'm going to tell a story because I think it's the easiest way to talk about this question. When I was in middle school, I had a very, very smart or very intuitive teacher who taught me band. Mr. Brandman, shout out. And Mr. Brandman basically said to us band geeks, if you want to make a career as an artist, specifically as an instrumentalist, a really great way to do that is by playing in the pits of musicals. So as part of our curriculum, he showed us classic movie musicals. So we got to see Fiddler on the Roof and My Fair Lady and West Side Story. Over the 3 years of junior high, and the year, he'd do this, encouraging us to go and see local theater, like go and see the shows at the Fifth Avenue or Seattle Children's Theater where I grew up. Like these, he was very much like, these are ways to turn this passion into a career, which I think is brilliant, especially talking to, you know, people in junior high. Again, at that point, I was like, maybe I'll be a pit musician, but of course, I played the oboe, and the oboe is like. Not an instrument that's utilized in pits now as nearly as much as essentially people who play oboe tend to play clarinet and mm-hmm. saxophone and flute, and then they're like, I also have this weird fun skill that's playing the oboe. Yeah. Like being an oboist is like, no, I'm gonna be in an orchestra, and like that's basically it.
Yeah.
But the year that he showed us West Side Story, there was a youth theater, shout out Studio East, in my hometown that was doing West Side Story, and naturally they were looking for vaguely ethnic youths to play sharks. And my younger brother was the first to audition. Trent will be the first person to tell you, but he also is the one who didn't book it. So,
oh,
but it wasn't his fault. Drama. He was just too young. Drama. It was literally. And again, I talked about like the age stratification. Sure. We're all very close in age, but when you're, you know, 12 and 13 and 15, that's like, very different. Sure. Being 12 and being 13 are like very different. And Trent was quite literally just on the like too young side to really do West Side Story. You like can't really put a child in West Side Story and think it's going to be okay. even though realistically it would be really interesting to do a West Side Story with only like ages like 12 to 17 as the Sharks and Jets, because, you know, that's actually what you're dealing with age wise.
Yeah, very true.
Don't do it. that's the challenge with Tony, is that like, the people who can like sing Tony the way that Tony is written to be sung and the people who are actually the right age to play Tony are not the same thing.
Right.
Anyway, so they were doing West Side Story, and my younger brother went, and they were like, do you have, then they found out about the siblings. So I went in, and then my older brother ended up getting it offered it blind because they just needed more sharks, which is this huge dramatic moment in our family. Cause
drama.
Trent of course auditioned and didn't get it. And then I auditioned and got it. And my older brother Blake didn't audition and got it.
Blake is offer only.
Offer only. Let's just tell you what. Anyway, so that was like the beginning of this, like, that's like a whole, like, if you want the story of my family drama, that like is this weird beginning point in it. But so I did West Side Story there. And so that theater, Studio East, did 6 shows a year, and 5 of them were musicals.
Okay.
So over the, between my 8th grade year and my senior year of high school, including the shows that I had done at school and other community theaters, I had done 22 musicals by the time I graduated high school.
Oh my gosh.
So I came out of high school with like this encyclopedic knowledge of musical theater, which I didn't even recognize was an encyclopedic knowledge of musical theater until I went to college and people were like, I did 2 musicals. Uh-huh. And I was like, I'm sorry, what?
Yeah.
And what role stands out the most to you from all of those, from those 22?
Oh God. I sort of bookend my, I was not great in high school at performing. So one of my early roles, I played Peter in Peter Pan when I was like 15, before my voice had changed. So I was like giving you Mary Martin soprano.
Yes.
And so that was like that was the third show I did at Studio East. And then my last show that I did at Studio East, I played Ren in Footloose. And so those were my 2 like big roles. Amazing. That I did. And those sort of like, between them, I like played the Rapunzel's prince slash the wolf, which was wild because it requires an insane, you're supposed to cast the wolf and Cinderella's prince. Mm-hmm. But my older brother was playing Cinderella's prince, so he was the older prince and I was the younger prince. Mm-hmm. But then I got cast as the wolf, so then I just had to do this mad quick change in order to this is a nightmare. And then I was like, it was like, all right, I would appear as the prince, but like only from the waist up, like behind a set piece, because I was wearing the like wolf pants on the bottom.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Because he has to like come in and like leave. And it's like this, oh God, the makeup, it was a mess. I did that. And I like, I was in like the dance ensemble of a bunch of shows. So I danced a lot because apparently I'm a dancer, not a dancer. Don't.
You missed some air quotes.
I was listening. Yeah. I'm a tapper. I can tap dance quite well. But
the moral of the story is that Heath can do everything.
Sure. Okay.
You can. I listed out all the things in the beginning, but it's never ending. And that's why I think, you know, you were on Broadway, you've done off Broadway, you just got back from being out of town. Mm. There's so many things that your resume is so long and will continue to be. And I can't wait to see what you continue to do.
Oh God, neither can I.
Yeah.
Yeah. The best is yet to come, right?
Yes. So the big things are like, I'm supposed to be like, follow me on Twitter.
Yes.
I'm hilarious.
Definitely. Feel the heat.
Follow me on Instagram because I'm weirdly thotty for no reason whatsoever. And then follow my website with my family so you can see what's up with them, which is thesaunderscollective.com. So feel the heath, thesaunderscollective.com.
And we'll include all those links and everything
you
as well.
You better. Yes. I don't appear on podcasts without actual plugs of myself and my career. Don't know.
So I, you know, we are sort of running out of time. So Ouch. Other than that, I just want to say thank you so much for doing this with us. You are brilliant. And I think that anyone who lets you into their ears through this experience is going to walk away a better person just knowing,
God,
you know, your incredibly valuable and unique experiences that you've had so far.
I just hope that people don't come away from it being like, you should cancel him.
No.
I like to say you should live your life like you're already canceled, unless you're canceled, at which point you should live your life like you don't exist.
All right.
Well, listen, I think you do have such valuable experiences to share. And you're amazing.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, my God. I can't thank you enough for being here, Heath.
Of course.
All right, so until next time, Connor.
All right.
Drama!